Hillary Clinton keeps on reinventing herself, from president's wife to scrappy contender for the Oval Office to Secretary of State. Our guest this hour traveled around the world with Hillary during her time as Secretary of State. She joins us this hour to give us behind-the-scenes looks at Hillary Clinton and weigh in on the realities of American power in the world today. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kim Hattas has been the BBC State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008 and travels regularly with the Secretary of State. She is the author of The Secretary, a journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the heart of American power, which has just been published. And Kim Hattas, welcome.
Good morning from Washington.
Good morning. Well, you and lots of other people just call Hillary Hillary. And these days, just that name is all you need to hear, and everybody knows who we're talking about. Is Hillary a brand name around the world now?
Well, to be fair, I call her Madam Secretary when I interviewed her as Secretary of State. And certainly in one-on-one conversations with her, I would never dream of calling her Hillary. I would call her Madam Secretary or Mrs. Clinton. There's always a distance, of course, that remains when you're covering a person as a journalist. But the word, the name Hillary, is instantly recognizable both in the US and around the world. So to some extent, a lot of people do indeed refer to her as simply Hillary. In the book, I alternate between Hillary and Clinton, depending on what moments I'm describing. I cover her as Secretary of State, so she's Secretary Clinton. But there are more private moments, more behind-the-scenes looks at the woman, and that's when, in the book, I call her Hillary.
Well, and she went in with a lot more pomp and ceremony than just about any other incoming Secretary of State. I mean, you describe the scene, and it sounds like, you know, Elvis is entering the building. And I guess, is it fair to say that when she assumed that role, that she was already kind of a rock star to people?
She was, of course, very well known both in the U.S. and overseas as someone who had been a first lady, who had been a senator, and who had just been on the campaign trail for the Democratic nomination in 2008. So she did come with a lot of instant name and face recognition. And that is one of the reasons, probably, why President Barack Obama decided that he needed her on his team as Secretary of State, because he knew that he was going to be busy with the economy and with a lot of other domestic issues at home. But there was also a great need for diplomacy around the world. And he felt that she had the stature, the name recognition, the skills needed to be America's ambassador to the world and to, in essence, stake her campaign around the globe in a new campaign for America. But of course, you know, Condoleezza Rice also had instant name recognition when she became Secretary of State because she had been National Security Advisor. And Colin Powell, her predecessor, Condoleezza Rice's predecessor, was also very much beloved and received raucous applause when he walked into the State Department on his first day on the job. But Hillary Clinton's reception in the building was really quite something, because she doesn't just appeal to Democrats or to people who voted for her or people who liked her as First Lady. She also appeals to a wider audience of women as well, who see in her a trailblazer for women's rights and children's rights.
Well, it was an interesting move on President Obama's part. I mean, this has not been, you know, a gentle campaign. This has been had been a bitterly fought campaign. They were very much rivals. And on the campaign trail, he had reduced her foreign skills or foreign diplomacy skills quite a bit. And yet here she was as Secretary of State. So going into that, did you have a sense about how she planned to enter that role and establish herself as someone with credibility?
You're absolutely right. President Obama reduced her skills on the diplomatic level as one that was just involving sipping tea with foreign leaders. But you have to remember that when she was first lady, she was often in the room talking to world leaders alongside her husband. She was often her husband's eyes and ears when he wasn't there on foreign policy issues. And she was one of the most, if not the most, political first lady that the US had seen in a very, very long time. But of course, she wasn't what we call in slightly wonkish terms a practitioner of foreign policy and diplomacy. So that is something that she did have to learn on the job. And she found herself very much at the beginning confronted with the fact that every word she now said wasn't just weighed in political campaigns or scrutinized by her political opponents on the campaign trail, but dissected and parsed down to the last comma by an international audience, by the world, because she was now speaking for America and every word mattered, every comma mattered. So there was a lot of adjustment that had to be done. And I go into that a little bit in one of my first chapters, how, you know, her aides were trying to figure out what kind of voice she had to have as Secretary of State, how she had to adjust to this new role, how she had to fit into the role. But to some extent also, because she was Hillary Clinton, how the role had to fit her.
Right, because she was a big personality coming in, and she'd had a large voice even before becoming Madam Secretary. And I wonder if you could just explain for us if she had a philosophy going in, an agenda about what she wanted to accomplish.
When she was confirmed as Secretary of State, in her hearing, she put out this concept of smart power. And that is a different approach to the exercise of American leadership around the world that involves, as she said at the time, deploying all the tools in the diplomatic toolbox. And that is diplomacy, but also defense and development. And she wanted to elevate development to the same level as diplomacy and defense, because this is a woman who really believes in the need to empower disenfranchised groups, whether they're women or children or students who feel that they're on that they're not being listened to by their leaders in Arab countries, for example. And we saw, the Arab Spring unfold. But I think that when she came into the job, there was still a lot of figuring out that had to be done about how she wanted to position herself, what issues she wanted to tackle or not tackle, and how she was going to do her job and position herself within a cabinet where the superstar, the real superstar of the moment, was, of course, the president.
Mm-hmm. And she had to establish herself. She had to gain credibility on the world stage. And she also had to work with Barack Obama and be part of his team. You say at one point her Girl Scout instincts kicked in.
Yes. I mean, she has said often that when the president asks you to serve, you say yes. It did take her a few times. He had to ask her several times. But in the end, she, in essence, said yes. And she had to figure out how she fit into that team and how she was going to serve the president. And it was quite interesting to watch how the two of them, President Obama and Hillary Clinton, adjusted to that new relationship, you know, putting behind all the acrimony from the political campaign and, in essence, realizing that they were now on the same team, even if their aides didn't feel like they were on the same team. Because I think that the tension between their respective aides remained throughout, and there was still a lot of mistrust and wariness on both sides, because, you know, Hillary Clinton is a big personality, is a powerful politician, has a global stature. And I think there was wariness in the White House about how this would work, whether she would try to overshadow the president, whether she would try to push her own agenda. And of course, the people who were loyal to Hillary Clinton were disappointed that she hadn't won the nomination and potentially gone on to win the White House. So there was a lot of patching up that had to be done. I don't think the mistrust between the two teams was ever overcome. But certainly the president and the secretary learned how to work together for the best interest of their own country. And it is a story that is very interesting to watch when you're overseas. And I know that a lot of her foreign counterparts and a lot of people in general in all the, you know, town hall meetings that she held around the world remarked on the fact that it was, in fact, quite remarkable that those two rivals could suddenly work together. And she always said, well, you know, that's the great thing about America. We both believe in what is best for our country. And we came together to do that, because in the end, their worldviews weren't that different, even though they had to sound like they were on opposite sides of the spectrum when they were fighting for the nomination.
We're talking with Kim Hatas, who has a new book out called The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power. She's been the BBC's State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008 and traveled for 4 years with Hillary Clinton, interviewed her 18 times. I'm Veronica Rickert. And Kim, I want to ask you about another part of her mandate going in, which was that she wanted to restore America's image around the world. She felt that it had been damaged during the previous 8 years, that America had acted a lot more unilaterally and wasn't that interested in cooperation with other countries. And she wanted to change that, right?
She did, but she was always very delicate about how she phrased that. And she never took a stab in very clear words at the previous administration. And it is a very delicate issue, because in the end, you want to put forward, you know, unified image when it comes to the new administration. You want to signal that there is going to be change, but you want to be delicate to some extent to your about your, you're talking about your predecessor. So she did say things like there's a great exhalation going around the world, but she never openly criticized the Bush administration, as far as I could observe. But there was a realization that no matter what you thought of the Bush administration's policies, whether you supported President Bush or not, that his 8 years in power were not exactly the golden age of diplomacy. There was a lot of unilateralism. There was a lot of you're with us or against us. And when you live on the receiving end of decisions made in Washington, the way I did, because I'm from Beirut, I grew up in the Civil War there, and I only moved to the U.S. 5 years ago, you know, that always, that approach to power doesn't always go down very well, of course. And there was a sense within this administration that the United States had to adjust, not only by improving perceptions of the U.S. and reaching out to allies and rivals in a different way, but also adjust to the reality of the 21st century, where the United States is still the biggest superpower, but not the only superpower. And it has to find new ways of advancing its own interests. And a lot of that requires collaboration whenever you can. Of course, you know, there are successes and failures, both for the president and for the Secretary of State. But there was a real desire to reach out and connect with people, not just world leaders, but also with people. And that's why we saw her, you know, at every trip she took, every stop that we went with her on those trips, she had a town hall meeting where she would speak with students or women entrepreneurs or NGO workers. That was a big part of her agenda.
Right. She seems uniquely suited to the job in that aspect, because she seems to have been all about genuinely wanting to connect with people on the ground. She didn't just want to be in a cloistered palace with someone with bodyguards outside. She wanted, you know, I guess like Bill Clinton, to be amongst the people of the world, the people that she was working with. And, you know, there's a scene early on in your book where she is, I think it's in South Korea, and she just keeps taking questions and they're personal. And it sounds kind of like the people there are blown away with her, and they're chatting with a best friend.
She does often come across as though she's your best friend, even if she's standing in a big auditorium with 3,000 people. And it makes the audience feel very special. And she does take a lot of personal questions. It often seems as though it's the only thing that people want to ask her about. There remains this fascination about this woman. But you have to keep in mind that she also faced a lot of very tough questions from people in countries like Pakistan, where there is a lot of hostility towards the United States because of American policies like, you know, the drone policy, which is being discussed in Washington as we speak. But she was willing to take those questions as well. And I think that that is something that people really appreciated, that she was willing to come and talk to them no matter what the question was, and that she was always willing to answer it as well. And I describe in the chapter where we traveled to Pakistan, you know, how she said, you know what, just make me a punching bag. She told her aides, you know, make me a punching bag, I will take all the questions. And she subjects herself to a battery of interviews, town hall meetings, more interviews for radio, for television, with students, with business leaders, with women. Because her sense was, you know, you got to talk to people, you got to let them vent. And then once you've diffused the tension, you can move on and try to move forward. And we saw that even with her exchanges with, you know, Pakistan's foreign minister. I was very interested to see how Pakistan's foreign minister was full of praise of Clinton. I thought I was going to hear a very critical opinion because of, you know, the relationship, the nature of the relationship between the two countries. And Hina Rabbani Kaur actually said, you know, I really appreciate that she was able to have these conversations in a very honest way as a woman, as a mother, and say, okay, how do we work together to move forward?
Did the Hillary Clinton that you saw over those 4 years as you traveled with her as part of her traveling press corps, did that Hillary Clinton surprise you when you contrasted the Hillary Clinton that you may have seen on the campaign trail?
I think that because of the nature of the job as diplomat and the contrast that that is to a campaign where it is all about being tough and fighting it out and battling out, I think the contrast was inevitable. But I do think that over the course of her 4 years as Secretary of State, she did relax. She did mature, obviously, as we all do. She's someone who is able to learn and evolve. And she's told me that she has learned a lot over the last 20, 30 years. Because I asked her, you know, you seem to be super popular now, but you were always popular and polarizing. You know, she's been up and down in the polls, so she's not necessarily universally loved. She still has her critics. But she said, you know, so I asked her, you know, is it that you are that people are seeing you for who you really are? Or is it that you have changed? And she said, well, it's probably a little bit of both. And I think that was a very honest answer.
We're talking this hour with Kim Hatas. She has been the BBC's State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008, traveled for 4 years with Senator, well, not Senator in this case, Madame Secretary Hillary Clinton, and interviewed her 18 times over those period of years. She's the author of the new book, The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power. And we're curious about what you made of Hillary's years as Secretary of State. Did she restore America's credibility abroad, as she had perhaps intended to do? And what do you think this may mean for Hillary Clinton on the political stage in the coming years? Would you like to see more of her, or do you think that she has maybe done her last job and that it's time to move on? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. And you can also find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickard Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stay with us next hour. We're going to talk about the art of fermentation with a self-described fermentation revivalist. This hour, we're talking with Kim Hatas about Hillary Clinton's years as Secretary of State. Kim Hatas has a new book out, and it's called The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power. And Kim, I know that maybe if Hillary Clinton had an issue, as many Secretary of States choose to pick an issue to focus on, hers was the advancement of women and children around the world and wanting to make sure that people knew her philosophy, which was that women's rights and children's rights are human rights. They're interchangeable. They're intertwined. Tell us a little bit about how that played out over the past 4 years.
Everywhere she went, everyone she spoke to, every world leader she met, she put the issue of women's rights and children's rights on the table in the conversation. And the way she approached it to get them to understand why she was going on about it is to put it in very practical economic terms for them. This wasn't just a soft human rights issue, an important one, but you know, you get the occasional or the frequent, perhaps even eye-rolling reaction from people, because you know there are a lot of issues that the United States has to deal with, from revolutions to wars to uprisings. So why is this Secretary of State coming to talk to us about women's rights? And the way she put it to them is by saying, you know, look, you want to help your country move forward, you want to improve your economy. Well, you're not going to be able to do that if you're leaving behind half the country's population. And it is something, you know, equality in pay for women, or, you know, why women aren't why there aren't more women CEOs is an issue that is being discussed in the US even. So it's not necessarily only something that you bring up in developing countries. It's a universal topic. So that's how she went about it. And then everywhere she went, she also met with women groups, whether it was in Afghanistan or whether it was in Africa. And she made sometimes world leaders go with her to those meetings, or to, you know, taking an African leader to a women's cooperative farm outside of the city, you know, a place that perhaps this leader had never been to, had never visited. So she made them see what she was seeing and what she wanted them to see. So that is definitely one of her very tangible issues that she tried to tackle. But on a bigger scale, I would say that what she tried to do as well is, as we've been discussing earlier in the show, to make America a desirable partner again. It's not always easy being a superpower. There will be people who love the United States or resent the United States, often in the same country, and often, you know, the same people will love the U.S. one day and resent it the other. It's not easy, and it takes a relentless campaign, if you will, to maintain America's edge in this day and age as a superpower. And that's kind of what I detail in this story that I tell in the book, because it is really a story. I take the reader to all these countries and presidents' palaces and kings' deserts retreats as I show them what it really is like this today to be America's ambassador to the world.
Well, I want to go back to Madam Secretary on the issue of women's rights and children's rights. This is a clip from March 15th, 2010, as she speaks before the UN Commission on the Status of Women.
Women are still the majority of the world's poor, the uneducated, the unhealthy, the unfed. In too many places, women are treated not as full and equal human beings with their own rights and aspirations, but as lesser creatures, undeserving of the treatment and respect accorded to their husbands, their fathers, and their sons. We must declare with one voice that women's progress is human progress, and human progress is women's progress, once and for all.
How effective do you think she was with that message?
From what I've heard from people who have met with her, who have worked with her, it sounds like she was quite effective, but it is a long-term effort. It doesn't happen overnight. People's minds don't change overnight. It's a constant battle. I mean, remember what we just heard there from 2010, where she said women's progress is human progress, is a slight sort of a difference from a twist on the statement that she made in Beijing, you know, almost 20 years ago, where she said human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights. So, you know, it's been ongoing in her mind, this battle to try to advance women's rights all those years. And there is progress, but it doesn't happen overnight. And she doesn't give up. I think it's, you know, one of her mottos, like Winston Churchill, don't give up, never give up. But I've heard from a lot of people who said, you know, it's become part of the mainstream conversation. When you talk to world leaders, it's become, you know, something that everybody is willing to talk about, including in Washington. We'll have to see whether it continues to be so now that she's not Secretary of State. But I've no doubt that she will want to pursue that agenda, whatever she decides to do next.
We're speaking this hour with Kim Hatas, who has been the BBC's State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008. She travels regularly with the Secretary of State and is the author of The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power. And we'd like to know what you made of Hillary Clinton's turn as Secretary of State. Did she change your opinion of her? And would you like to see more of her on the political stage in the coming years, perhaps in 2016? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Kim, one of her first trips, in fact, I think her very first trip was to the Asian Pacific region. And that trip, that first trip, gets a lot of weight in terms of significance. She stopped first in Japan. Can you tell us about what that trip was like and what it represented?
She decided very early on that Asia was the place to go on her first maiden trip. And it took a lot of people by surprise, including the Japanese, who had never received a Secretary of State on a maiden voyage. I mean, they'd received plenty of visits from American Secretaries of State, but never had one chosen to visit Japan on her first trip, on her first stop. And it was fascinating to see the reaction, because I think it's sometimes easy to forget the weight that a visit carries by an American Secretary of State, and every statement that American Secretary of State makes, or the president, everything is parsed and observed and scrutinized and put under the microscope. And the Japanese were frantically trying to figure out, you know, had this ever happened before? Why is she coming here first? What's the message? Why is she coming to see us? How come? And then, of course, you have to be careful that you don't make any diplomatic faux pas, that you don't upset your allies. So she had to include South Korea. Otherwise, they would have been upset that they were not included in the trip. And you can't really go to Asia and not visit China. Otherwise, that sends a signal that you're about to embark on an antagonistic relationship. But no need to give them a bear hug either. So we'll make that the last stop. So there's a lot of thinking that goes into these trips. It looks effortless, but it's actually a painless exercise trying to put them together. But just in a nutshell, you know, it was her first foray into, or not her first foray, but her first trip, her debut on the world stage as Secretary of State, because obviously she had traveled to more than 80 countries as First Lady, but this was a very different role. And she learned the hard way that everything she said was going to be scrutinized. And she got a huge backlash because of comments she made about human rights and China, appearing to signal that there were bigger, more important things to discuss with China. So she got really very harshly criticized by human rights groups in the United States and elsewhere, who were very concerned about that. And she says that's not what she meant, but it's certainly how it was perceived. And she had to spend a lot of time correcting that.
Well, I want to go to our callers now and take our first call from Joy, who's joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Joy.
Hi. I find this to be a really interesting program. When Hillary Clinton ran for president, I thought that her presidency, if it would have happened, would have been bogged down in issues far beyond her, the president. And I thought that when she became Secretary of State, that she potentially had an opportunity to really use her skills and have much more influence than she would have had as president.
And what do you think, Kim?
Yeah, I'm happy to comment about that. Look, I think that you are onto something, because it was an opportunity for Hillary Clinton, absolutely, in many ways. I mean, obviously, she had to weigh the pros and cons of accepting a job offer from her rival. And she made the calculation from a politician's perspective that it would serve her well. I think that's probably how she saw it. Not only would it serve her country, and that she would be able to take on some of those big issues that matter to her, like women's rights, but also in general, restoring or redefining the exercise of American leadership, but also, you know, restore her own image and show what she has to offer beyond just politics. So there was definitely an opportunity there for her. And we've seen that transformation. I mean, she's remained above the political fray, outside of the political fray, for the last 4 years. And at the end of it, you know, she has some of the highest approval ratings she's ever had. And, you know, she's one of the most popular politicians in the U.S. So it served both her and the country that she is serving, and the president, of course. It's very hard to say, you know, what it would have been like if she had gotten the nomination and if she had then gone on to win the presidency. But I sure think that if she decides, and it's a big if she decides to run in 2016, her 4 years as Secretary of State will add to what she brings to the table.
She has grown in popularity, as you just said. In general, her turn as Secretary of State has been well received. She's not without critics, though, and it has been said, I think, in the New Yorker that she was a better ambassador than she was a Secretary of State, that she was wonderful at connecting with people and being there on the ground and getting involved, as you said, but that she didn't accomplish much. What do you think she would say to those critiques?
I asked her that exact question, because when you weigh the legacy of Secretary of State, you look at all the issues that they tackled and you try to figure out, OK, so what is it that they've actually done? And there is no doubt that she did not manage to get a peace deal in the Middle East. There is very little progress in talks with Iran, North Korea. Let's not even go there. No success on the horizon at all. You know, the reset with Russia is, you know, in jeopardy. It's not exactly going very well there either. So there are definite failings. And then, of course, you have the ongoing war in Syria. I asked her whether she agreed with her critics, tough question, whether she agreed with her critics that she'd been an inconsequential Secretary of State. And her answer was that this was a narrow way of looking at what the job of a Secretary of State is today. From her perspective, there was a lot of work to be done to make America a desirable partner again, to repair or improve perceptions of the United States around the world, particularly at a time, you know, you have to remember that when she took the job in 2008, there was also a big financial crisis ongoing. And there was a lot of talk about American decline, about, you know, retreat of the United States. And she set out to undo that image. And I think that she did succeed on that front. And I think that's, you know, the bigger takeaway from my book as well, that this is what she really set out to do and did it relentlessly. Because, you know, it's a complicated world out there. There are a lot of countries rising who want a bigger say on the world stage, whether it's big countries like China, who are your number one rival, or smaller countries that also want a bigger say in world politics, like Turkey. And it takes a relentless public diplomacy effort, relentless traveling, to maintain America's edge, if you will, and to maintain America's position as Secretary of State. You have to constantly be showing up everywhere.
And I want to go back to the phones now. Let's take another call. Ray joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray. And hello, Ray, are you there? No. Well, we'll move to Mac, who is near Wabisa. Hi, Mac.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. We're discussing Secretary Clinton this morning, I believe. And I still have a major issue with Benghazi, and I feel that the people that were in power at that time were actually watching that in real time and just essentially sacrificed our people over there. And I believe that Mrs. Clinton was involved, and I don't think that that charges are out of order here.
I want to, before you answer, Kim, I want to play a clip from one of her fiery moments during the Benghazi hearings before the U.S. Senate.
Supposedly protest, and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But
and the American
people
could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator. Now, honestly, I will do my best to answer your questions about this, but the fact is that people were trying in real time to get to the best information. The IC has a process, I understand, going with the other committees to explain how the...
And a bit of a clip there from the hearings before the U.S. Senate, Hillary Clinton discussing Benghazi there. And Kim, I know that you have talked about that moment as being this quintessentially Hillary Clinton moment where you really saw a genuine side of her. But again, this is, as Mac has said, this is not without controversy here. And those remarks have been interpreted in lots of different ways. What do you think?
You know, Benghazi will continue to be associated with her tenure. And if she decides to return to politics, it will be put back on the table. And of course, it continues to be debated and questions continue to be asked today about what really happened or what didn't happen and what questions actually still remain unanswered. Because I do think that the political nature of the debate has somewhat marred the picture about what still remains to be answered. And I think as a journalist, you know, we try to report on the facts, we try to get the facts, and we report on all sides of the story. I do get the sense, or we have reported on the fact that, you know, the Obama administration's reaction, response, their messaging was a bit mangled in the aftermath of the tragedy in Benghazi. But from where I'm standing, from all the reporting that we've done, there are still unanswered questions, but a lot of the questions that keep being asked about what happened have already been answered. Some of these outstanding answers are with the CIA or with the White House or with the Pentagon. I think there are a few questions that Hillary Clinton still has to answer. For example, would it have made a difference if she had seen the cables about requests for more security? But unfortunately, I think that, you know, when you look at diplomacy by the United States around the world over the course of history, these tragedies happen. Everybody does everything they can to avoid them. But it's unfortunate that it is perhaps something that is part of doing diplomacy in dangerous places like Libya, but also Beirut, where I grew up. And that's what motivated me to write this book in many ways, because I had a lot of questions about the United States growing up, about how much power it had or didn't have and why it did certain things and not others. And I was there in 1983 when the Marine barracks were blown up under President Reagan's watch, and when the U.S. embassy was bombed as well. These tragedies happen and people try to learn from them. But I think that people like Chris Stevens' sister, you know, Chris Stevens is the ambassador who was killed in Benghazi. And I spoke to his sister, Anne Stevens, who said she really hoped that the administration would not pull back from the Middle East, would not stop pursuing the policies of engagement that Chris wanted to do as a diplomat, and that she said, you know, I really hope that the U.S. doesn't just retreat behind a wall into a fortress, because that outreach to the Arab world has to continue.
We're talking this hour with our guest Kim Hatas, who has been the BBC's State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008. She has a new book out. It's called The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power, which has just been published. And we're taking your questions and comments this hour and wondering what you thought about Hillary Clinton's turn as Secretary of State, and wondering about whether you'd like to see more of her on the political stage in some public service capacity, maybe a run in 2016, and how you thought she performed, what she accomplished as Secretary of State. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. They're called nightmare bacteria, new drug-resistant superbugs lurking at hospitals. Can we stop them? Join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at some creative ways to outsmart these bugs, thinking beyond the antibiotic, plus Al Gore on his new book, The Future. I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this hour is Kim Hatas. She has been the BBC's State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008 and has traveled regularly with the Secretary of State, including 4 years with Hillary Clinton. And the subject of her new book comes from those 4 years. It is called The Secretary. And we turn again to the phone lines. We've got Jeff joining us next in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
This is really interesting. First of all, I put out front there, I am a supporter of Obama and of Clinton very much so. The question, though, has she made a difference? I think you really have to say it depends. And for instance, in Europe, where seems so much depends upon style and tone and process, then yes, I think she's made a big difference. And I think her style there, at least when I travel a lot overseas, her style is much appreciated. In the Middle East, Central Asia, though, where people are probably much more focused on or hopeful for looking at outcomes and looking desperately for changes in foreign policy, I've had friends tell me that the Obama administration policy, much of which obviously includes Clinton's participation, has made no difference at all. They see very little difference going back many years. So I, for one, prefer the change in approach and style, but many in the world might not be quite so lenient or forgiving. But anyway, I think it really depends. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. And Kim?
Yeah, I'll make a quick comment. Obviously, I am myself from the Middle East. I still have a lot of friends and my family lives in Beirut. So I go back often and I detail some of the reactions that people have to America's foreign policy in many of my chapters. And it's a very interesting point because, you know, remember that just 4 years ago, people in the Middle East were incensed, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, if not most, were incensed with the Bush administration's policies because there was the invasion of Iraq, there was Guantanamo Bay, there was the scandal of Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. And people were furious that the U.S. was trying to push them around. And, you know, this is how they perceived it. This is how they lived it. They wanted the U.S. to leave them alone. There was a lot of criticism of that. And then fast forward 4 years to today, there is a lot of resentment that the U.S. isn't doing enough, isn't helping the Syrian rebels, for example, by arming them, isn't criticizing the president of Egypt more or even booting him out because he's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that complaint in Egypt comes from those people who feel that they're on the losing end of that election, those who supported President Mubarak or Christian Copts who are fearful of what a Muslim Brotherhood president will mean for them. So in a way, it's very difficult to please everybody. And I, you know, totally take Jeff's point that there will be people who will not be too happy with the Obama administration's policy or Clinton's legacy. And that's why what I believe I do in my book, The Secretary, is to show all those different perceptions of what the US can offer, whether what it cannot offer, what its possibilities are, what its limitations are. But, you know, there is one thing that Hillary Clinton told me, which really struck me, and I write about it at the end of my conclusion. You know, she says, you know, we can't change everything on our own. We need people to help themselves to help us. You know, and we saw that, for example, with Burma, where it was the Burmese who decided that they wanted to open up. And then they reached out to the US, and in response, the US, you know, went along with them on that. It always requires the other side to be willing to change or move forward. It's not always easy, and it's not because the US decides that it wants something that it is going to happen. I'll just read you very quickly something from the book. An American official complaining to me in the midst of the Egyptian revolution. He says, this is the irony here. On the one hand, we're being accused of dominating everything and dictating everything. And on the other hand, we're being accused of not dictating everything and dominating everything. These are choices to be made by the Egyptian people. And, you know, I continue and write on and say, no matter what Washington did, the world expected something different, because people always want the US to respond to what it is that they want. But other people want something else, and the US may also have a different perspective on what is needed, but also what is best for the US.
When you were growing up in Lebanon, your family and lots of people around you thought that if the US lifted a finger, it could greenlight an invasion by Syria. And that if the US wanted to stop civil war in Lebanon, it could do the same with, you know, a single phone call. Is that idea of U.S. foreign power still in play, do you think, today? Or do you think that the world stage has changed enough now that other countries are realizing that there may not be this one giant superpower in the U.S. and that maybe even those assumptions that, you know, you made when you were a child, that those just aren't true and maybe they were never true?
You know, I think that the idea of America as the omnipotent power that can just push a button to make things happen has been there for a long time. It's ingrained in many of our brains, our reactions, our perceptions of the U.S. It is changing, but I think that people's perception of the United States is lagging behind the reality. I don't think the U.S. was ever able to just push a button and make things happen. I detail some of the frustrations that previous American administrations had, going back to President Truman and the Clinton administration, when, you know, the U.S. was seen as the sole superpower, described even by the French rather critically as the hyperpower. That perception has always been there. I think the world is changing. There are more people, more countries that want to have a role, that have a role, that are pushing to have a bigger say. And I think that's what Hillary Clinton and President Obama tried to do. How do you manage that? How do you work with rising powers that aren't just rising, but that have arrived on the world stage while maintaining America's edge? So I think it's an ongoing process.
And how do you think that process is going to evolve? You know, we're seeing Hillary Clinton moving on, taking a rest, figuring out what comes next. We're seeing John Kerry moving in. How do you expect to see American foreign policy evolve?
You know, the old adage of, you know, events. We'll have to see what the world is going to do on its own. You know, you can't always control everything. No one expected the Arab uprisings in 2011. But I can tell you briefly about the difference in style that John Kerry brings to the job. Because the worldview of Hillary Clinton, President Obama and John Kerry is, you know, they're Democrats. They're more or less the same. There are variations, nuances. One is more forward-leaning, a little bit more hawkish than the other, etc. But overall, they believe in American leadership based on smart power for the 21st century. I would say that's my takeaway. But John Kerry is a little bit more traditional in his approach so far. He is more about working with world leaders, a little bit less public diplomacy. But Hillary Clinton would argue, as she did in one of my interviews with her, that it's because she and President Obama did the groundwork of reestablishing some of those alliances in the first 4 years of President Obama's term, that it is now possible to pursue more specific agreements with people or with countries, rather. And I've no doubt that John Kerry will try to pursue Middle East peace in a way that Clinton didn't, although her aides will dispute that. But Hillary Clinton didn't really pursue Middle East peace and give it her all because, you know, she's a politician at heart. And I think she decided that she was not going to stake her reputation on the thankless task of Middle East peacemaking. So she wanted to focus on the bigger picture.
Well, Kim Hattas, thank you so much for joining us this hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. It was wonderful.
Kim Hattas has been the BBC State Department radio and TV correspondent since 2008 and travels regularly with the Secretary of State. She has a new book called The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power, which has just been published. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this one and to Rhonda Fanning for technical direction. And thanks also to Jennifer Dargan for answering your phone calls this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.